On December 15th, we celebrate the 150th anniversary of the adoption of our Bill of Rights. It's been the habit of Americans from that day forward to jealously guard these rights as guaranteed in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. It's possible that no nation of people ever enjoyed so much individual liberty and freedom to develop their maximum potentialities as the people of this country have enjoyed for the past 150 years. We have, however, been less aware of our responsibilities. And out of the failures of individuals and groups to meet the responsibilities that go hand in hand with these rights have grown complex social, economic, and political problems with which we are faced today. It's for this reason that your town meeting, rejoicing in the privileges of freedom, directs your attention not only this week and next, but constantly to the responsibilities we face individually and collectively if we are to preserve this way of life we hold dear. No less important than the Bill of Rights is the preamble to our Constitution, which reads, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." This magnificent declaration of purpose implies individual and collective responsibilities, some of which are included in tonight's discussion. In order to preserve the freedoms of democracy, then, what must we do to improve the health and well-being of the American people? We've asked the distinguished president of the Associated Hospital Service of New York and former commissioner of the Department of Hospitals of New York City, Dr. S.S. Goldwater, to speak to us about the health of the American people. And Miss Margaret Burke White, ace photographer, co-author with her husband Erskine Caldwell of Say Is This the USA? And You Have Seen Their Faces, to report on living conditions in this country as she finds them. And Mr. Howard Coomley, chairman of the Walworth Company and former president of the National Association of Manufacturers, to speak from the point of view of business. And our distinguished First Lady, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, to suggest the role that government should play in this field. And now it's my pleasure to present our first speaker, Dr. S.S. Goldwater, president of the Associated Hospital Service. Dr. Goldwater.
Mr. Denny, ladies and gentlemen, we are asked tonight to discuss the nation's health and to show how it can be improved. It's a large order. More than ever in these troublous times do we need abundant vitality and mental buoyancy. But more fundamental than strength and determination for effective participation in the national defense is the belief that human beings are entitled to an opportunity to grow to full stature in body, soul, and mind. Underlying a sound health program for the United States, there must be an unalterable faith in democracy. Those who are best qualified to deal with this subject are, I suppose, physicians and public officers. And this is not intended to reflect on the eminent qualifications of my distinguished platform associates tonight. Now, the views of practicing physicians are apt to be drawn from close observation of a relatively small number of clinical cases, while the views of public health officials are largely based, or mainly based, on soaring statistics. There are many ways of preparing statistics and even more ways of interpreting them. Assuming that all deaths are recorded, mortality statistics at least are reliable, and the general trend of our mortality reports is reassuring. Statistics of disease are another matter. Records of even the reportable diseases are never complete. Many cases of communicable disease and many other incapacitating illnesses and injuries are never even seen by a doctor. Some are seen but not recorded, while others are recorded under clinical classifications that are so vague as to be difficult to handle as statistics. Political economy used to be called the dismal science. Today, the science of public health, if it is a science, seems even more dismal. For in public health circles, it has become the fashion, partly on the basis of loosely compiled statistics of physical defects, to picture the United States as a decadent and decrepit nation. We are told that we are a toothless, almost sightless people, that we have flat feet, flabby muscles, and weak minds. We are warned that we are undernourished, that our vital organs are degenerating, that we are no match for the germs of disease that are within us and all about us. I, for one, refuse to subscribe to this doctrine of despair, for it is a doctrine founded on half-truths. It is true that physical defects are common among us, but many of the defects that are used in the compilation of alarmist statistics are only minor defects. I have sometimes been amused by the apologetic air with which doctors of medicine and public health offices present their depressing tabulations. Now, while it is true that medicine has not yet solved the problem of the common cold, and that public health administration has not yet been able to guarantee perfect living and working conditions for everyone, both professions have accomplished such wonders in our time that an attitude of abject humility ill becomes them. I take off my hat to the doctors and public health officers of the United States. Just now, because of the dislocation of industry and the migration of several million defense workers, deficiencies in housing, recreational facilities, and medical care, deficiencies from which we are never quite free, stand out in menacing relief. But many industrial and labor leaders share with the government and with the medical profession a desire to create acceptable working conditions and housing conditions and to develop effective plans for medical care. Let us encourage them to keep at this indispensable job until it is finished. Fortunately, we have a government which is concerned with our well-being. When such a government is informed that remediable physical defects are common, that diseases are widespread, and that many of them are preventable, that timely medical care is not available to all of its citizens, it is to be expected that alert officials will spring into action. The familiar indictment asserts that private medical practice, the voluntary hospital system, and local health administration have failed. It is therefore inferred that medical care must be administered by government, since government alone is in a position to promise that no preventable illness will be disregarded, that no sick person will be neglected. I am ready to acknowledge the difficulty of immediately providing prompt and sufficient private medical care for all regions and for all classes, but I believe in the practicability of substantial further progress under private and local initiative and control. Although government aid may be and no doubt is required, the limits of self-help have not yet been reached. There is much that we can do for ourselves. Let's do it. There are many hopeful signs. Medical education is improving all the time. The unsolved problems of medicine are under constant attack. Many cities and some entire states are now well supplied with hospital beds. Farmers are banding together to secure needed medical service. Industry is subjecting itself to more rigid health supervision. Employers are cooperating with their employees in providing medical care. Housing reform is now an accepted public policy. Discoveries concerning nutrition have made it possible to plan for the better distribution and the wider use of food. Childbirth has lost most of its terrors. The significance of Planned Parenthood is understood. Tuberculosis slowly declines. Dentistry is being brought into proper focus with medicine. Public health nursing is expanding. Outpatient services are improving. Home medical service is being provided for families on relief. For the great mass of regularly employed low-income workers, a powerful economic barrier to prompt hospital care can be removed by the wider development of voluntary prepayment plans for group hospitalization and related medical care. I do not decry government interest or participation in the spreading public health movement. On the contrary, I am eager for government action where, owing to ignorance, to callous indifference, or to the limited resources of economically depressed groups or regions, gaps remain. But I doubt the possibility of establishing and maintaining a single, centralized federal agency on which the multitudinous population of these vast United States can safely rely for prompt, adequate, skillful, and sympathetic medical care. I submit for the consideration of a generous-minded government, eager to protect the lives and enhance the well-being of its people, a number of considerations derived from long experience. Current medical science and art have their limitations. These limitations should be taken into account, and perfect health and happiness should not be recklessly promised every time a public appropriation is made for any health purpose. The direct administration of medical aid for the underprivileged by huge federal agencies is not likely to be economical. Such aid, when needed, should be administered locally to avoid the pitfalls of remote bureaucratic control. A substantial fraction of increased government expenditure is likely to be absorbed by the simple substitution of paid for unpaid medical service. This may be no more than just to the doctors, but money so expended does not provide increased volume of service. The greater frequency of contact between individuals and physicians, as in periodic physical examinations, means more costly, not cheaper, medical care. The saving is not to be looked for in medical expense, but in increased working days and more abundant health. A health program for the United States must include more than the medical care of the sick and injured and such classic but meager sanitary services as the control of water supplies and sewage and the pasteurization of milk. It is known that unsatisfactory socioeconomic conditions affect health. These and all other environmental influences injurious to health should be attacked in a comprehensive program. If such a program draws its inspiration from faith in and a desire to achieve the ends of democracy, we need have no misgivings concerning its ultimate success.
Thank you, Dr. Goldwater. Now may I present our second speaker, Miss Margaret Burke White, ace photographer and author of books on America's social conditions. Miss Burke White.
If Mark Twain were standing at my place this evening in front of the microphone, he might possibly say, "Everybody talks about democracy, but nobody does anything about it." If our democracy is going to continue, it must provide for the people as well, if not better, than the totalitarian states do, certain basic commodities: healthful conditions, adequate education, and economic welfare. The apparent prosperity at present is misleading. When this period is over, democracy will meet its severest test. But even now, it is a mistake to believe that bad health and substandard living conditions do not exist on a large scale. For example, I remember one family I visited recently in a cotton-growing region in Georgia. Their house was so densely covered with advertisements for Buttercup Snuff and 666, which claims to cure malaria, fever, and chills, that it was difficult to see the house at all. On a bench against the wall sat a tiny girl who announced that her name was Begonia. When asked how big her family was, she informed us that she had a heap of brothers and sisters but hadn't ever counted them. Her pinched face contrasted with the blooming beauty in an ad over her head, in which an exquisite girl stated that Chesterfields satisfy. But when the mother came to the door, it was evident from her black teeth that she felt that it was chewing snuff that satisfied. Snuff is something that many impoverished families will buy ahead of food because it dulls the pain of aching teeth and of empty stomachs as well. The inside walls were as plastered with newspapers as the outside had been with posters. This handmade wallpaper serves the practical purpose of helping to keep the cold winds out. It serves the ironical purpose of displaying on the walls a host of attractive commodities in well-turned advertisements, which the family will never be able to afford to buy. The mother sat down on one of the several sackcloth crates, which supplemented the single chair that the room possessed. And rocking back and forth, she explained how body sickness made it hard for her to keep up with her work. Among these children, which Begonia had found too many to count, were a pair of twin girls who went to school, at least they went in a way. In cold weather, they went singly, so they could alternate between them the use of a tattered man's coat, which had been in the family longer than anybody could remember. There had been 17 children in the family altogether. 5 were dead, 4 were married. The rest had existed last year on the $65.60 which the sharecropper father had realized on his half of his 3-bale cotton crop, plus a welcome $4.88, which came from the government as a crop benefit, totaling $70.48 for the year. The children, like so many thousands of Southern children, were disfigured with carbuncles and scabs in a way that it is unpleasant to describe. And, of course, they also showed the effect of malnutrition and rickets. The twins, who divided up the family coat for their winter school days, made out much better than their cousins, who lived back in the wood in an old stable without a floor, and whose parents, ex-tenant farmers, now cut wood and picked berries for a living. These cousins attended the same school in warm weather, but they petered out when it got so cold that going in bare feet down the wood road to meet the school bus became too painful to make education practicable. However, white children, however ill-shod they may be, have an advantage over black ones when it comes to going to school, because they have a chance to use the school bus, while Negro children find that the school bus for them is a rarity. I have seen some Negro schools which do not even have a schoolhouse to meet in. The Happiness Church, or the Church of Great Joy, as it might be called, had to serve. Here the little black tots sat on pews and boxes, studying from their ancient and inadequate textbooks without sufficient paper or pencils. For these, they could not afford to buy. While over their heads hung incongruously a sign, "Come to the house of prayer and forget your troubles." A fine, intelligent type of Negro principal in So-So, Mississippi, complained to me that his Negro teachers get only $25 a month, while the white teachers seldom get less than $100 a month. They can hardly afford to go to summer school on their $25 and increase their training. Every time I talk to the white people about it, the principal said, some of them always say, my people don't need much education to get along. And if half the Negro children dropped out of school, we would need only half as many teachers, and the ones that were left could get twice as much salary. Our country lacks some of the aspects of democracy when these colored people, who must pay taxes as regularly as their white neighbors, derive such dissimilar benefits. It lacks some of the advantages which might be expected of a democracy when great masses of people, in their ignorance and poverty, spend their insufficient pennies on patent medicines or on snuff, instead of benefiting from a system of medical and hospitalization insurance which would ensure them proper care when needed. Our country is forgetting the importance of its babyhood, when children must take their chances on the kind of houses in which they happen to be born, while local nurseries or district health services might give them the start in life to which they are entitled as infant citizens. It is not that our democracy has completely failed in taking care of its citizens' welfare. Good measures exist: the Wages and Hours Bill, Social Security, Free City Hospitals, relief measures, and so on. But there are great gaps. The Wages and Hours Bill does not help agricultural or the majority of domestic workers. City hospitals do not reach rural districts. Perhaps the creation of a new government department is one answer. It could coordinate these welfare measures, create new ones, and fill in the gaps. And it might be called the Department of Social Security. Health is a national investment, as we all have been shocked to discover in the last few months, when more than 40% of our young men have been proved unfit physically for the draft. But it is not just to improve the quality of our soldiers that we must raise our nation's health and welfare. I have seen soldiers of the fascist nations. I've talked with some of them very recently when they were taken prisoners on Russian soil. And while they were undoubtedly physically fit to carry rifles, they were mentally fit to be little else than cogs in a great war machine. The blankness of their faces, the poverty of their minds, their character as complete automatons, gave sufficient testimonial as to the rigid mold into which they had been pressed. Our democracy promises its citizens more than bread alone. We have a country with a proven ability to create wealth, and if, instead of only part of our citizens, 100% of them might benefit from our great resources, our democratic government can continue to hold its lead among the nations of the earth.
We pause a moment now for station identification. Continuing America's Town Meeting of the Air from Town Hall in New York City, where we're discussing the subject, What Must We Do to Improve the Health and Well-Being of the American People? We've just heard from our first two speakers, Dr. S.S. Goldwater and Miss Margaret Burke-White. And now it's my pleasure to present Mr. Howard Coonley, chairman of the Walworth Company and former president of the National Association of Manufacturers. Mr. Coonley.
Mr. Denny, Mrs. Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen. The management of American industry is deeply concerned with the improvement of the health and welfare of industrial workers. Several years ago, the National Association of Manufacturers, whose 8,000 members represent a cross-section of American industry, formed a committee on healthful working conditions. It is composed of industrial leaders and is guided in technical matters by an advisory committee of industrial physicians and hygienists. Its chief consultant is Dr. Victor Heiser, author of many valuable and widely used studies in health. Through these years, it has collected and distributed many valuable suggestions for improving the health, increasing the comfort, and raising the standard of welfare of industrial workers. The experience and findings of those industries which have taken the lead in health and safety work have been gathered and brought to the attention of industry generally in a far-reaching and systematic program. Practical means of providing adequate medical service, sanitation beyond legal requirements, better lighting, heating and ventilating, and maximum safety have been studied, explained, and urged, and year by year an increasing number of factories throughout the country have used such measures as have been suggested. A few months ago, the association published the report of a health survey covering 2,000 plants and nearly 2 million workers in 47 states. It indicated that 43% of the plants reporting had established health services during the past decade, and 70% of the programs instituted within the past 5 years were in plants having less than 500 employees. Since institution of such definite health programs, the reports indicate that the average reduction in occupational diseases has been 63%, in accident frequency 45%, and in compensation insurance premiums about 30% reduction. More recently, a self-rating checklist has been issued to enable manufacturers to compare the health activities in their plants with a guide accepted as good practice by both operating executives and health experts. Let me mention some of the items, for they are representative of industry's program. As to health and safety control, the program includes having a licensed physician and a graduate nurse in the plant each week on regular schedule, maintenance of plant dispensary, complete periodic physical examinations, low-cost hospitalization plans, organization of a safety committee composed of employees and management, and personal instruction of all employees in first aid and safety. As to factory hygiene, the program includes temperature control, provision for proper ventilation, elimination of hazards from dust and gas, assurance of adequate light at working surfaces, and regular competent inspection for sanitation and for control of occupational disease. As to health education, it urges that employees be instructed in personal health habits, as well as in avoidance and prevention of accidents and occupational diseases through posters, newsletters, house organs, and meetings. It also recommends cooperation with public and private agencies concerned with prevention of accident and disease. I should note also the earnest thought being given by the association and by manufacturers generally to the problem of employment of industrial workers whose age requires readjustment of tasks or who are unable to find work on account of age, to the problem of racial discrimination insofar as employers may contribute to its solution, and to the problem of temporary displacement on account of technological change. These are some of the lines along which industrial management is working and will continue to work. But there are limitations to what manufacturers can do, even for their own employees. They cannot dictate. They must adjust their course to the rules prescribed by government, the regulations of labor unions, and the financial requirements of a going business. They cannot dictate. In spite of urgency of problems, their efforts may not meet the cooperation essential to a successful solution, while on the other hand, the public may put the responsibility on employers alone. Manufacturers invite and need cooperation from all groups in the undertakings we are discussing tonight. The machine age has raised economic and social problems that must be solved. We face the requirement of increasing social responsibility on the part of all groups. The American people are opposed to regimentation of their activities, to arbitrary and inflexible controls that stifle individual initiative and voluntary cooperation. Isn't it by a widespread voluntary cooperation rather than by coercion that we are making a wonderful record and building an arsenal for democracy? Indeed, in the unhappy business of war, which requires extraordinary concentration of authority, we find that the more we achieve voluntary cooperation, the better we perform the task before us. And I believe the most satisfactory solutions of our problems of health and welfare can be reached only in this democratic way. The impact of world forces and of social forces within the nation does not allow us to rest in complacent contemplation of past achievements, to muffle our eyes and ears against social change, to stand still. We must plan our course, but we Americans are competent to make decisions, to plan together, to use our freedom intelligently for promoting our common welfare. We have had an experience in democracy that gives us confidence in the superior long-run effectiveness of democratic processes. The increasing revelation of our productive capacity that this emergency is bringing us is an inspiring challenge. We have the same resources, material and human, the same varied skills and organizing capacity for peace as for war. Individuals and groups are gaining new experience in cooperation. Can we not bring them into better understanding of one another's purposes and functions and recognition of their mutual responsibilities for after-the-war progress? In the diverse enterprises of the people, we want the freest and widest possible use of the tremendous productive energy now being revealed. We need to apply it not only to the production and distribution of goods for an economy of abundance, but also to the wider provision of social services which such productivity makes possible. Let us look forward to the transition from war to peace, not as a period of confusion and depression, but as a time of unparalleled opportunity for using our free institutions to make a better America for all its people.
Thank you, Mr. Coonley. And now it's my honor to present our distinguished First Lady, who speaks tonight in her own right as a formal student, author, observer, and lecturer on health, social, and economic conditions in America, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
It seems to me that the government can do a great deal for the health of the nation at the present time, which it might not have been able to do except in a period of emergency. I think we should face our health problems just now, first on the level of defense, and then on the level of long-range problems and plans. In the category of defense efforts, I think we should immediately set about rehabilitating every man who has been rejected under the selective service because of correctable or remedial physical defects. The highest percentage of men rejected was for defective teeth. There has been suggested a plan for dental clinics by a very able doctor, which I hope is now being given very careful consideration by the Surgeon Generals of the Army and Navy, as well as the Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service. It has always seemed to me that we neglect this important phase of health where school children are concerned. I question very much whether we can leave this question of the young people's health entirely to the individual parents. I think we must begin to consider the health of the children of every community as a community responsibility. It is important to every citizen that the generation growing up shall do so with an opportunity for adequate medical care to prevent serious defects in later life. I'm sure that all of us are concerned to learn that 57,000 of the first million men examined for the Army were rejected because of venereal disease, but it is a relief to know that all these can be made fit for service in a short time. General Hershey estimates that malnutrition is responsible for about one-third of all rejections on physical grounds. Here again, I think we are at fault as citizens, in that we do not see that every child in school receives one balanced meal a day. The Oslo breakfast, which was carried on in Norway by prominent nutritionists and which has been adopted in many other countries, is used either as a breakfast when children first come to school or as a luncheon at noon. And it should be duplicated in every school in our country. It would be a good investment if it prevented the waste of human beings through tuberculosis and other ailments that have their roots in malnutrition. We are now reconditioning boys for the Army in camps run by the National Youth Administration with good food, which incidentally many of them have to be taught to eat. Exercise to correct bad posture and to promote coordination, rest, and regular hours, most of them will be able to go into the service. A certain amount of health work has been carried on in the National Youth Administration and in the Civilian Conservation Corps, and if they are now to be coordinated under one head, it is hoped that this health work will become an integral part of the whole plan, because so far it has only been incidental. Many of the countries already at war show a rise in the rate of tuberculosis. This is probably due to fatigue, increase in strain due to increased employment in industry, and poorer nutrition in face of the rise in the cost of food and the necessity for rationing. While we are not in as serious a position as they are, there undoubtedly will be a percentage of increase here, and we should be preparing for it now by getting extra hospital beds for the care of tubercular patients and by trying both in government and in industry to make up through extra care for the added strain under which people are working. The clinics we now have for the treatment of venereal diseases are not sufficient and should be extended. The community should now begin to think about the prevention of infection as well as the treatment of infected persons. And if communities cannot achieve the necessary care themselves, they should obtain assistance from the federal government. The Public Health Service and the Children's Bureau should work closely with the state and local health agencies. Programs should be developed for the care of the mother and the child in every community. We should try to look ahead to the problems which greater employment in factories for women will necessitate. The establishment of day nurseries and the organization of nursery schools and kindergartens in order to provide adequate care for the children is now a necessity. We should do all we can to encourage the entry of qualified young women into the nursing service, and the government should take steps immediately to stop the rise in the cost of living, which will eventually increase malnutrition among the children of this generation. One section which I notice in a report which I saw from Surgeon General Parron is entitled Health as a Part of Education. He says there is too much emphasis on a winning football or track team, too little physical education of all pupils. There are too many superficial physical examinations, too little corrective medical and dental care. Courses in physiology are too theoretical, emphasizing the mechanics and chemistry of the body. Too little practice in healthful living. I think it is the duty of the government to bring before the people their responsibility to see as far as possible that the community provides the services needed and acquaints the people in every locality with the existence of such services. We must reach the goal of a healthy nation, sound in mind and in body.
Thank you, Mrs. Roosevelt. And now, as we begin our question period, let me take this occasion to extend a special welcome to a large number of visiting delegates to the annual Congress of the National Association of Manufacturers, which is meeting and are present here in our audience tonight, a meeting here in New York this week. Let me remind you, questioners, in this audience of 1,600 Americans, that there's a prize of $25 for the best question asked by a member of our audience here in Town Hall this evening. So make your questions brief and to the point. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and when recognized, rise and state the name of the person to whom your question is directed. The gentleman right here.
Dr. Goldwater.
Dr. Goldwater.
I seriously doubt whether America realizes that over 70 million sick people lose over 1 billion days from work at an annual cost of $10 billion with attending social calamity. Do you not agree that a national conference of leaders of medicine, of industry, of labor, of the church, and of government to formulate a voluntary national health program will assist in solving the deficiencies of medical care of our less fortunates in America?
Dr. Goldwater?
I have no objection to the multiplication of conferences. Such a conference, as you suggest, has already been held. It was held under government auspices only a year or two ago. I have no doubt that the repetition of things that we know is desirable in order that all citizens may become acquainted with it. And I have no doubt that every time every such conference, as you suggest, is held, new information is brought to light. But I doubt whether at this particular moment a conference is needed, because the multiplicity of conferences that are going on various aspects of the question that you put seems to me to suffice for the moment for the education of the people, if only they will attend.
Thank you. Next question.
Dr. Goldwater.
I want one to somebody else. This gentleman?
Mr. Borgwine.
Mr. Borgwine?
Do you feel that socialized medicine would benefit the health of the American public?
Yes, I feel it would. I know that there are many objections, sometimes from private physicians who don't wish to lose their practice, sometimes from private hospitals who don't wish to lose their clients, but I see no reason why some form, at least of medical insurance or hospitalization insurance, can't be put into effect, and people who can afford to go to their own physicians, people who can afford to go to their own hospitals, still can continue to do so. But people who can't possibly afford treatment, or who perhaps could afford it at one time and may not be able to have the $2 they need when their need for the doctor comes around, will still be able to be taken care of.
Thank you.
This question is directed either to Dr. Goldwater or Mrs. Roosevelt. Since with the Puerto Rican population in New York, it has been found that there's over 50% of this population suffering either from tuberculosis or incipient tuberculosis, also so many venereal cases, why has not there been, or should there not be, a United States government established a board of health station at the port of debarkation, allowing no one to board a ship unless he has a clean bill of health?
Mrs. Roosevelt, will you speak on that first, and then I'll ask Dr. Goldwater.
I don't really know what the regulations are in this particular port, so I would rather let Dr. Goldwater answer, but I imagine the United States government could lay down certain regulations, but I think probably they would prefer to have local regulations govern. Now, I don't know, Dr. Goldwater, what the real answer is. Come, you answer what the real answer is on that.
I suppose the principle involved is making contact with individuals who are ill. You could set up observation stations at every corner and refuse to allow anybody to pass who was ill. We have a vast amount of administrative machinery today that brings the government and our public health services into contact with the people. We might go on multiplying that endlessly. I doubt whether the particular form of administrative machinery that has been suggested by the speaker is necessary in New York City at this time.
Thank you.
Mrs. Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt, what do you think of the idea of taking all of the benefits that are derived in the hospitals in the large cities, creating in Washington a Department of Health in the President's cabinet so that all the information can be recorded there and sent to all of the little places out through the country so that they can have the benefit through a cabinet position, the same as everything else, and get the benefits that we get in a large city?
Yes. The gentleman asked the question, Ms. Roosevelt, what about making available to all of the physicians in America through a cabinet position the information that is now available to the doctors in the large cities?
Through a Department of Health.
Yes, through a Department of Health, the cabinet position.
That's been long discussed. The multiplication of cabinet positions is always a difficult question. There are a great many people who want a separate department for education. There are others who want a separate department in many, many different categories. At present, the Public Health Service is, I think, doing a pretty good job of sending out information throughout the country. It may be that we will grow to the point where we need more cabinet positions. There's a great deal of agitation for one on the arts, and I don't know just which one would win out, and they do come one at a time.
Dr. Goldwater. Considering the general ill health of our poor, how but through a large government program can their health be improved?
Dr. Goldwater? Considering the general ill health of the poor, how but through a government program can their health be improved?
Now, the question assumes that there is no government program. 50% or more of the people of the city of New York today have at their disposal government service for every conceivable kind of illness. Now, I said in the course of my address, that it would be inadvisable to attempt to treat all the people of the United States through a single centralized department. I made that statement because of my experience in the administration of medical organizations dealing with large masses of people. Local self-direction of medical organizations composed of proper units for effective medical service is preferable to government aid. I conceded in the course of my talk that when self-help, and local programs fail, that's the time for the government to step in and fill the gap.
We're taking a question from the balcony here from Mr. Coonley.
Mr. Coonley, assuming that the National Association of Manufacturers represents enlightened management, what has it done to police the smaller plants where occupational hazards are uncontrolled and consequently of high incidence?
To police the small plants.
I must confess that we have no policing powers. I think the greatest powers in the country are those of example and influence. And it's through example and influence that we try to persuade not only our own members, but manufacturers generally, that a contented workman is an efficient workman, and a healthy workman is the most efficient workman.
Thank you, sir. I see here in the audience, in the box next to the gentleman who asked that question, a speaker who's appeared on a program similar to this before here in Town Hall, Dr. Kingsley Roberts, the director of the Medical Association Service, an authority on the subject of health care. Would Dr. Roberts care to comment for a moment?
Thank you, Mr. Denny. I would like to make just three short statements. First of all, it is my opinion that any health program which is going to be of social importance in this country must start thinking not at the therapeutic level, not at the treatment of disease, but at the lessening of the incidence and severity of disease. We must think about preserving the working power of the worker. We must think about preventive medicine. We must think about lessening the cost of medical care, because if we are going to produce systems which will be supportable by the lower and lower income groups, that care must not be expensive. And if it is going to be inexpensive, it cannot be cheap. It must be on a preventive level. The second is that we must think about the improvement of the quality of medical care as well as the quantity. It is no good to produce more bad medical care for people. It is important that we produce more better medical care for people. In order to do that, we must create systems which are scientifically and economically attractive to physicians, because physicians are the only people who can give good medical care. Not only must they be physicians, but they must be good physicians. You cannot get medical care out of a can. You cannot get it out of a book. You can only get it from a man who chooses to give it to you. Therefore, you must make whatever system you are going to have to improve the health and welfare of our American people attractive to good physicians.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roberts. Dr. Goldwater, would you care to comment on what Dr. Roberts has said?
Nobody can dispute that better medical care is better than good medical care, and that the best is better than better medical care. We all believe that to be true. What Dr. Roberts says, of course, is profoundly true. It is desirable to attack disease, not during its final stages, but during its early stages, and particularly, if it can be done, these conditions should be dealt with by preventive measures. It has been the tendency of public health administration in this country during the last 50 years to move steadily in that direction. I believe that it's pretty well understood now by public health officials that there is nothing that we do, that there is no work in which we engage, there is no activity that in any way concerns us, whether it be recreational or occupational, that doesn't impinge on our health. In the last analysis, a comprehensive health program would be one related to every act performed by every individual during every hour of the day. Now, of course, it isn't conceivable to build up an organization will interfere with our lives to that extent. And it's a mistake to assume that the only health work that is being done is the work that is being done under the direction of health officers. Mr. Cooley has called your attention to activities which, with the assistance of the medical profession, are being carried on by manufacturers and industrialists. And I might go on to show what the educators are doing, what the newspapers are doing by way of education, what dietitians are doing. All of these magnificent aids contribute to the health of the nation. I believe with Dr. Roberts that the primary emphasis should be placed on prevention.
The lady in the green dress.
Yes. Bert White.
It's Bert White. Oh, I was wondering.
There are those who advocate federal aid to education in order to equalize educational opportunities in widely varying sections of the country. Do you suppose that the people of New York and other northern states would be willing to have part of their tax money used to improve the educational opportunities of the Negroes and the white people in the South, especially in Mississippi, where the percentage of Negroes is extremely high and very little money is available from local taxes?
How about the Negroes in Mississippi who also pay taxes, which indirectly benefit the citizens of New York City? I feel that, after all, if this is going to be a unified nation, color boundaries must be forgotten. I feel that education is a tremendously important form of national insurance, especially in these days when fascism is sweeping the world. And since Negroes form a large part of our population, I feel that we must all of us realize that raising their educational level is part of our national insurance.
If fear of want and substandard level of living cause most disease, should not stress be laid on the preventative rather than the curative?
Yes, well, that was the point that Dr. Roberts just made. If fear of disease and want are fear and want are the cause of most disease, shouldn't stress be laid on the preventative rather than the curative? Do you want to speak to me? No. All right. The gentleman right here.
Mr. Goldwater.
I want one for somebody else now. We've given an awful lot of time to Dr. Goldwater. The lady here.
Mrs. Roosevelt.
Try to keep these things balanced.
Doesn't Mrs. Roosevelt think that a wider recreational activity program and a wider program in creative work in the arts would lessen the need for medical work?
Yes, I think that all those things are a part of preventive medicine because they do lessen the strain on people and make it possible to keep well.
Have you a question, Dr. Roberts?
Yes, I'd like to ask Tony a question.
All right, go ahead.
Industry has learned that there are 400 million man days lost per year through illness. It has also learned that only 10% of that is due to industrial illness and accident. What is industry prepared to do to try to recuperate the 360 million man days lost through non-industrial illness and accident?
I'm sorry, I was checking on the time when that question came in, not doing my job as moderator. The last part of your question, will you repeat it?
If the audience will bear with me.
Just the last part.
There are 400 million man days lost yearly to industry. 10% of that is due to industrial illness and accident. 360 million man days are lost through non-industrial illness and accident. What is management prepared to do to try to lessen that amount of lost man days?
Yes, what is management prepared to do to lessen the condition which he described in terms of those statistics, which I won't attempt to repeat? Well, I think Mr. Coonley has described what management is doing.
I think, again, it's a question of example. As I understand your statement, it indicates a pretty good performance on the part of management. Now, perhaps management could extend its influence outside of its own field.
All right. Mr. Coonley? I do think that your question, your speech answered that question in part.
Mr. Coonley again.
Mr. Coonley, again.
Mr. Coonley, what has industry done to help their workers in the way of rest homes and vacations? Many.
Yes, all right, we've got it. Thank you. What has industry done to help workers in the way of rest homes and vacations?
There's been a tremendous advance in the granting of vacations to workers. There also has been a more moderate advance in the providing of opportunities for rest and recreation away from work. I am sure that after this period of intense activity to try to readjust our production from peace to war, we will find new methods of providing for the recreation and the rest of our people.
Thank you.
Mrs. Roosevelt.
You, please.
Mrs. Roosevelt, you spoke of the importance of health in connection with civilian defense. Along those lines, I would like to ask what the individual can do in his community to better the health standards of that community, rather than saying the government should do this and the government should do that.
That's a large order for 1 minute, Ms.
I think what the individual can do is first to know what the conditions in the community are, and then to see what, by getting together in the community, people can manage for themselves, and then take advantage of everything that government or private organizations offer. Too often we fail because we don't know what there is available in the community to take advantage of.
Thank you, Mrs. Roosevelt. I wish we had time for comment from a distinguished English scientist who's just arrived from England and is in the audience tonight, Dr. Julian Huxley. Will you rise and let us have a look at you? Thank you, Dr. Huxley. I wish we had time to hear from you. Of course, we've just begun to discuss this question for the topic is to be the subject of our $1,000 prize essay contest, which Mr. Herlihy will tell you about while our judges, Dr. Arthur Bester and his associates, decide upon the winning question here tonight.
Yes, Mr. Denny. Ladies and gentlemen, $1,000 in cash prizes will be presented to the winners of an essay contest on the subject of tonight's discussion. What must we do to improve the health and well-being of the American people? Two $250 first prizes, two $100 second prizes, two $50 third prizes, and 20 $10 prizes for honorable mention will be offered to the winners in two divisions. One set of prizes will be awarded to those 21 years of age and over, and a duplicate set to young people under 21 years of age. The first ranking winner in both the adult and youth groups will be given a trip to New York City or any other city in which the town meeting originates at the time the prize is awarded, and an opportunity to appear on America's Town Meeting of the Air. The essay must not exceed 1,000 words in length, and all entries should be addressed to the Town Hall in New York City and postmarked on or before February 1, 1942. The decision of the judges is final. Every essay submitted becomes the property of Town Hall, and everyone is eligible except members of the staff of Town Hall and the National Broadcasting Company and members of their immediate families. It is not necessary for you to have a copy of tonight's broadcast in order to enter the contest, but if you wish to secure a copy, send your request to Town Hall enclosing 10 cents to cover the cost of printing and mailing. And if you wish to have these town meeting bulletins sent to you regularly for the entire season of 26 weeks, send $2.50.
And next week, Mr. Herlihy?
Next week, our subject will be, How Should We Deal with Propaganda Today? And our speakers will include Mr. Roger Baldwin, director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Mr. Morris Ernst, prominent New York attorney, Mr. Eugene Lyons, editor of the American Mercury and author of the well-known book, The Red Decade, and a fourth speaker to be announced.
And now, Dr. Bester, what about tonight's winning question?
Do you think it would be beneficial to establish a Department of Health under the direction of a cabinet officer?
That gentleman was in the balcony, wasn't he? Yes, sir. If you'll come around after the meeting, we'll be delighted to hand you a check for $25. What is your name, please? What is your name, please? Your name?
George W. Jacobs.
George W. Jacobs of New York?
New York.
Fine. Come right down after the program. Thank you very much.